This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Milton. U.S. authorities said Sunday they have identified Anthony Quinn Warner, age 63, as the man who blew up a motorhome at dawn on Christmas Day in Nashville, Tennessee. DNA testing showed his remains were present in the wreckage. U.S. Attorney Donald Cochran said at a news conference Sunday that Warner is believed to have acted alone. He said authorities have not determined a motive. One theory is that the explosive was meant to damage communications networks. The motorhome was parked near an AT&T communications building when the bomb went off. Telecommunications services in several states were briefly interrupted as a result of the blast. The explosion damaged dozens of buildings and sent three people to the hospital with what police said were non-critical injuries. With the clock ticking toward a potential U.S. government shutdown, President Donald Trump on Sunday signed a $2.3 trillion spending bill, which he had previously criticized as a disgrace. The plan includes $900 billion for coronavirus relief. The rest is for government spending through next September. The president criticized the bill after it had been passed in the House and Senate, capping months of negotiations between the lawmakers. The bill was flown from Washington, D.C. to Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago club in Florida to be available if the president decided to sign it into law. Without Mr. Trump's signature or passage of a stopgap measure to fund operations, a partial government shutdown would have begun shortly after midnight on Monday. Increased unemployment benefits and eviction protections for Americans whose income was affected by the pandemic expired early on Sunday. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. United Kingdom authorities are expected to approve the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine this week, and the head of the company said it will be as effective against the virus as the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna vaccines. If approved, AstraZeneca's vaccine will be the fifth vaccine put into play around the world to fight the virus. Early tests showed that the vaccine was 70% effective for preventing illness, compared to 95% reported by Pfizer and BioNTech. Russia and China also have their own vaccines. The latest vaccine on the horizon comes as the world reached the grim milestone of 80.7 million people worldwide infected by the virus, with 1.7 million world deaths globally, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. In the United States, 19 million have been infected with the virus, and some 330,000 Americans have died of COVID-19. On Sunday, several European Union countries began vaccinating against COVID-19, aiming to inoculate more than 450 million people. And in a video Sunday marking the International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, the first of a planned annual event, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the chief of the World Health Organization, said, quote, "History tells us that this will not be the last pandemic, and epidemics are a fact of life." The United States has called for the immediate release of a group of Hong Kong democracy activists facing trial in China on Monday after they attempted to escape the territory by speedboat for sanctuary in Taiwan. 10 of the so-called Hong Kong 12 are due in court in the southern city of Shenzhen, facing charges linked to an illegal border crossing. Chinese authorities took them into custody after their boat was intercepted on August 23rd. At least two of the group face up to 7 years in jail for organizing the attempted escape. Democracy activists last year led massive protests against Beijing's rule. Some of the group are already facing prosecution in Hong Kong, where China has imposed a national security law that has stamped out the city's protest movement. A U.S. embassy spokesperson told the French news agency Sunday, quote, "Their so-called crime was to flee tyranny." The diplomat, of course, was speaking of the defendants. That comment came just hours ahead of the group's scheduled court appearance. The diplomat urged the, quote, "immediate release of the Hong Kongers," adding, quote, "Communist China will stop at nothing to prevent its people from seeking freedom elsewhere." More on that and other stories at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, and from Washington, this is VOA News.
welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting has begun in Sunday's Niger presidential election.
Voters are happy about the fact that this is the first time the country is going through a transition from one democratically elected government to another without any disruption. For many Nigerians, this is quite a significant milestone.
In Zambia, a police report about the killings of a lawyer and an opposition supporter is due today, Monday. UNICEF says a quarter of a million displaced children are at risk of deadly diseases in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province. And Ugandan police shoots a journalist while dispersing Bobby Wine supporters.
I was fully identified as a journalist, but all of a sudden, Abaine appointed the tear gas gun at me and shouted, "Collateral damage!" And he didn't even hold back. Again, he cocked that tear gas gun and then pointed at us.
And remembering the late Malian politician Soumaïla Cissé, those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Has begun in Sunday's Niger presidential election that observers say would mark the first time that the country will witness a transfer of power from one democratically elected president to the other. VOA's Hausa service reporter Macmo Lalo is in the Nigerian capital, Niamey. He says voting was for the most part peaceful throughout the country.
Voting started as early as 8 a.m., even though there are some pockets of reports where voting started a little bit behind schedule. But by and large, from the information I gathered in some polling units around Niamey, Niger's capital, elections started smoothly with quite a good number of voter turnout. So is the case in states like Dosso, which is very close to Niamey, and Tillaberi, Damagaram, and Tawa. In general, I would say the voting started quite smoothly.
Now, you and I talked last week about the importance of Sunday's vote. Now, did you have a chance to talk to some of the voters in terms of what this vote means to them and their country?
Yes, voters are generally more concerned about economy and issues related to security as well as coronavirus, which Niger is seeing a second wave of the pandemic with a record high of 147 new cases seen on Sunday last week, just in one day. But another issue I noticed, James, is that voters are happy about the fact that this is the first time the country is going through a transition from one democratically elected government to another without any disruption. For many Nigerians, this is quite a significant milestone.
Now, Magmo, who do you think stands the better chance of winning? The ruling party candidate, Mohamed Bazoum, or the opposition candidate, Mahamane Ousmane?
A lot of attention is being directed at the ruling party PNDS candidate, Mohamed Bazoum, who is a close ally of the outgoing president, President Yusufu, whose five-year two terms is ending April next year. But then, James, this is an election. Anything can happen, considering that Mahamane Ousmane of RPR, who is Bazoum's major challenger, is enjoying a good backing from the major opposition party, Lumana, whose candidate, Hama Amadou, was barred in the race by the Constitutional Court.
When do you think, when are they expected to announce at least preliminary results or maybe final results?
Niger's electoral laws give CENI, the electoral body, 5 days to release a provisional result, which will be submitted to the Constitutional Court, who will then officially announce the winner. But let us not forget the fact that if no candidate secures 51% of the votes, the election will automatically go into a second round. So we've seen previous elections in Niger overlapped into a second round, where they will select the two candidates that have the highest votes to run in that second round.
Mahmoud, thank you very much again. We'll be in touch with you on Monday.
Thanks for having me, James.
That was VOA's Hausa service reporter Macmon Lalo speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Niamey. Ugandan police Sunday asked for digital evidence to assist in their investigation into the events that Sunday resulted in the injury of three journalists as police attempted to disperse supporters of opposition presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. In another development, the Ugandan Monitor reported Sunday that Bobi Wine had to suspend his campaign appearance scheduled Sunday in two towns. Halima Atumani has the rest of this story.
In a video posted online, musician-turned-politician Bobi Wine is heard telling a police officer he is headed to Luengo District for a rally after leaving a church service in Masaka District. A confrontation ensues and police spray tear gas on Wine's car and those around him.
We are going to Luengo. You are taking a lot of our time.
As Wine's vehicle goes into reverse, more tear gas is fired. Cameraman Ashraf Kasirie, who is doing a live shot for Ghetto TV, folds, reportedly after a rubber bullet strikes him just above his left eye. People start screaming.
The police and President Museveni's government is afraid of seeing Kyagulanyi getting the support.
Kasiri was rushed to a local hospital before being transferred to Kampala for further treatment. He is reported to be in critical condition. Ali Mivule, a television journalist with NTV, was reporting from the scene when he was surrounded by police and the military, who then started dispersing the crowds using the tear gas and rubber bullets. Mivule accused the police commanding officer, whom he identified as Enoch Avaine, of then turning his tear gas gun on journalists.
I had a full body armor and I had the headgear. I was fully identified as a journalist, but all of a sudden, Avaine pointed the tear gas gun at me and shouted collateral damage. Poo! And he didn't even hold back. Again, he cocked that tear gas gun and then pointed at us.
Police say their task force had violent confrontations with Wine and his supporters after he ignored the route plan. Charles Twine is the spokesperson for the Criminal Investigations Department.
Unfortunately, and most regrettably, some journalists were caught up in a scuffle during the process of dispersing the violent supporters. Notable among them was a Ghetto TV crew member identified as Ashraf Kasirie, who sustained an injury on his upper left eye, allegedly from a blunt object force.
Police say their media crimes department is investigating the circumstances regarding the journalist's injuries. Robert Sempala, national coordinator of the Human Rights Network for Journalists, is urging police to take stern action against any security personnel found to have deliberately attacked journalists. Sempala notes that in the past, security forces attacking journalists have not been held accountable, saying impunity for such crimes is entrenched. The violence in Masaka District comes just a day after the Electoral Commission cancelled campaign events in 10 districts, including Masaka, many of them opposition strongholds. The commission stated that this was done on the advice of the Ministry of Health, identifying them as hotspots for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Last week, the Committee to Protect Journalists said Ugandan authorities should ensure that the press can freely cover the presidential election scheduled for January 14. The CPJ cited accreditation hurdles faced by journalists ahead of the vote. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu is expected to receive a police report today, Monday, about the shooting deaths of two people, a lawyer of the National Prosecution Authority and a supporter of Hakainde Hichilema, the leader of the main opposition United Party for National Development, the UPND. Police say lawyer Nsama Chipioka and the UPND supporter Joseph Kawunda were shot at different locations at the police station. The U.S. Embassy in Zambia urged a full investigation to bring to justice those responsible for the deaths. The Law Society of Zambia also condemned the killings and called for an investigation. Washington Katema is the team leader of the Southern African Human Rights Defenders Coalition.
Our concern is the continued police brutality in Zambia, and at a global level, within the Zambian context, the what I would term as democratic backsliding or authoritarian regression, especially as a build-up to the 2021 August presidential election. We have seen a rapid shrinking of the civic, political, and democratic space in Zambia. And what we witnessed on December 23rd, which is the killings of Nsama Nsama, a state prosecutor, and Joseph Kaunda, a member of the United Party for National Development, is only a telltale sign of the bigger, the macrocosm picture of what's happening in Zambia. The political temperatures are rising, and the state is taking a heavy-handedness in terms of its response to dissent.
The police have launched an investigation, and I think a report is expected Monday. Do you think the police can do an impartial investigation, or what would your organization like to see happen?
What you want is justice, and beyond justice, both justice exists in a context. Zambia is ought to be a democratic society, and we expect the top leadership, the elite leaders in Zambia, to respect the constitution and to respect the international norms, standards, values, and so forth. Zambia is assigned to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, especially Article 25, which speaks to about the role of citizens in public affairs, what they can do in terms of demanding accountability to those who are in power, also demanding accountability to those who want to be in power. So the case we witnessed on December 23rd is an ordinary citizen, in the case of Joseph Kaunda, going to the Supreme Court to show solidarity support to the leader of the United Party for National Development, who had been summoned to appear before the courts for a case which happened in 2004, 2 years before he joined politics, like when he acquired a piece of land. And another incident is of the state prosecutor who was caught in the crossfire in the Milere and lost his life. And as I think if you followed the burial for Joseph Kaunda today, you would see by the scenes that Zambia is fast sliding into an outpost of tyranny. And I think President Edgar Chagua Lungu needs to exercise self-restraint and respect the constitution of Zambia and even the international law in terms of protecting its own citizens.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Washington Katema is the team leader of the Southern African Human Rights Defenders Coalition. You're speaking with us from the Zimbabwe capital, Harare. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 28th. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says a quarter of a million displaced children in Mozambique's conflict-ridden Cabo Delgado province are at risk of deadly diseases with the onset of the rainy season. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Children account for nearly half of the more than 530,000 people who have been forced to flee their homes in the face of escalating violence in Mozambique's northern province of Cabo Delgado. UNICEF says children have faced many dangers over the past 2 years, including a devastating cyclone, flooding, drought, and economic hardships brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. UNICEF spokeswoman Marixi Mercado tells VOA these children now are threatened with an outbreak of deadly waterborne diseases such as diarrhea and cholera and the further spread of the coronavirus. She says severely malnourished children in particular are at great risk.
Because basically, severe acute malnutrition is a potentially life-threatening condition, particularly for children who are already sick with malaria or measles, which exists in Cabo Delgado. So children who are suffering from other conditions can be up to 9 or 10 times as likely to die as a normal child would be from severe acute malnutrition.
UNICEF says 2 out of every 5 children in the province are chronically malnourished. Mercado notes these children require therapeutic treatment and specialized care to survive. UNICEF, she says, is sending mobile health teams to screen children for their nutritional status and provide treatment for severe cases.
We're also, I think, very worried about children who've been exposed to high-risk situations and have seen or experienced physical and psychological violence. And for this, it's crucial that we strengthen the protection response for these children, which includes psychosocial support and really long-term, you know, support and care.
UNICEF is appealing for nearly $53 million to respond to the most urgent humanitarian needs in Mozambique over the coming year. This includes $30 million for the particularly acute needs in Cabo Delgado. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigeria's COVID-19 infections recently witnessed another significant increase. This has prompted the government to announce measures to curb the spread of the virus, especially during the holiday season. The country has reported about 80,000 coronavirus cases and more than 1,200 deaths. Gift Agiriga reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
With the confirmation of a second wave of COVID-19 in Nigeria, the chairman of the Presidential Task Force, PTF, on COVID-19, Boss Mustafa, announced new guidelines to limit the spread of the virus.
The Presidential Task Force has surveyed developments and action taken by governments around the world. The PTF wishes to issue advisories to the subnational entities, meaning the states, for implementation over the next 5 weeks.
The government asked states to ensure the closure of all bars, nightclubs, restaurants across the country for an initial period of 5 weeks, as these places are known for spreading the virus.
Restrict all informal and formal festivity events, including weddings, conferences, congresses, office parties, concerts, seminars, sporting activities, end-of-year events, to a number of 50 persons.
Mustafa also said that public transportation systems can carry only half their normal capacity in compliance with social distancing rules. As many Nigerians travel to their home communities for the Christmas and New Year celebrations, health officials are worried that the infection numbers might increase. Dr. David Ushie, a consultant physician pathologist with University of Calabar Teaching Hospital, says the public has not fully observed the government's prevention measures.
Yes, proactive measures are clearly defined. Compliance is very poor. People are not worried about the individual cases happening around them. So we are up against a difficult task ahead of us. And Christmas is here.
Ushie emphasized that the government's measures require a disciplined population that take the measures seriously. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga in Abuja.
A Malian politician says the late opposition leader Sumaila Sise will forever be remembered as a major contributor to the entrenchment of democracy in Mali. Yasamaki says the late Sise will specifically be remembered for the 2013 election when Sise took his entire family to concede to the incumbent who had won the election at a time when many expected him to challenge the results. Sise died Friday in France at age 71. He was kidnapped in March this year by jihadists while campaigning in the Timbuktu region of the country ahead of the legislative elections. Sise was released in October this year and had been viewed by many as the leading candidate in the coming presidential election. Yasamaki says Sisi's death is a loss to not only Mali, but the whole of Africa.
We are very saddened by the shocking news of Sumaila's passing. This was not expected. We did not know of his illness until the announcement of his passing in France. This was a shock for many in Mali. I'm not a member of Sumaila's party, but I acknowledge Mr. Sise's contribution to democracy in Mali. We acknowledge the major role he's played for the past three elections, where he has come second in each of the elections from 2002 to 2018. Sumaila has really been a contributor to democratic process in Mali, and Mali certainly lost. It is a tragic loss for the people of Mali. I can say it's a tragic loss for Africa.
How do you think he will be remembered?
He will be remembered specifically for the 2013 election, where he took all of his family to go to the incumbents, who had won the election and congratulated Ibeka and his family for their victory at the election. This was a moment in the history of our nation where the whole nation stopped and hold their breath and watch this unfolding. Instead of contesting the election, Sumaila conceded, even though he had doubt that the election was fair, this he will be remembered by. But we also remember Sumaila for his role at the parliament as the chief opposition leader in Mali, his role in organizing hearing at the parliament and confronting members of the government, including the prime minister, when they called a motion of censor on the prime minister of Mali. Those were some very tense moments that Sumaila was a key player in the democratic process in Mali.
The late Sumaila Cisse was just released after being kidnapped and was favored to be a leading candidate in the coming elections. What does his death mean now?
Well, this is a loss for Mali. Sumaila was seen as the favorite contender. But it's too soon to speak about what's next. We are still mourning the passing of Sumaila. This is a major event for our nation. We will focus on mourning and supporting his family, political and biological family, at this time. At a later time, our mind could be open to other matters, but today our hearts are broken, and we are thinking of Sumaila and his family, and this country is indebted to his contribution to public service in Mali.
Yes, Samake is a Malian politician. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bamako. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Nigeria, where professional club football resumed on Sunday, 9 months after it was suspended as a result of the outbreak of COVID-19. The new season will be competed by the same teams from last season, as no team was relegated due to the nature of the last season's pause. On Sunday, defending champions Plateau United started the new season on a disappointing note, going down to a 2-0 home defeat against Kwara United at the New Jos Stadium. Football fans were glad that football actions were back, even though just a handful of them were allowed into the stadium as part of measures put in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
It's good to have the league back, but I'm worried that the Minister of Sport has to be the one to always get the LMC to start the league. Now, yeah, you're talking about COVID-19's second wave. It's not where you're starting your own league, when others are going, on lockdown, but the league has started, so it's good to have the league on back anyway.
I want to give a special thanks to the Minister for Youth and Sport, who has, for the second consecutive year, compel them, you know, to commence the league.
The league itself is basically like a reflection of the economy of Nigeria. Things not being put in the right places, and you get this sort of result. So, like I keep saying, hopefully we get it right.
In the CAF Champions League, Kenyan club champions Gumahia once more faced an early exit from the CAF Champions League after suffering a 6-0 whooping defeat at the hands of Algeria's CR Belouizdad in the first leg of their first round tie in Algiers on Saturday. In the midweek games played just before Christmas, reigning African champions Al-Ahly of Egypt opened the defense of their CAF Champions League title with a 1-0 win over AS Sonidep of Niger, with Aliou Dieng's first half goal putting them well on course for the group phase. Sudanese sides of Al Merrikh and Al Hilal were triumphant over Nigeria's Eibar, beating them 3-0 at home, and Ghana's Ashanti Kotoko 1-0 away respectively, while DR Congo heavyweights TP Mazembe overpowered AS Boingidi in Gabon. Stade Malien goes into the reverse fixture over Moroccan giants Wydad Casablanca with a 1-0 home win, while South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs continue to struggle in front of goal after a goalless stalemate at home to Angola's Primeiro de Agosto. Staying with football, Portugal and Juventus star Cristiano Ronaldo has been named Player of the Century ahead of rival Lionel Messi at the 2020 Globe Soccer Awards. Other players who lost out to Ronaldo were Brazilian legend Ronaldinho and Mohamed Salah of Liverpool and Egypt. Ronaldo Ronaldo was voted to be the best player between 2001 and 2020 at a star-studded event held in Dubai after winning 5 Champions League titles, 3 Premier Leagues with Manchester United and 2 La Liga trophies with Real Madrid, as well as the Nations League with Porto. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. That's it for this Monday, December 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.